Breaking the Panel is made possible by you and other listeners just as awesome as you are. If you want to support the show and get a little something in return, just go to patreon.com/breakingthepanel, because we do appreciate the help.
I mean, I would just stare at Captain America's shield for hours.
I would just stare at his pecs for hours. Klotzy, I thought you were going to be, that's fair.
Well, no, you're not talking about Aquaman.
Hey, Jason Momoa is gorgeous, okay?
So. Yeah, no, we've talked about that. I've acknowledged that.
Yeah, I'm almost afraid if I were ever to come across him in real life to make eye contact.
Oh, yeah, let's be real. I mean, like, you don't want to make eye contact because you might fall in love.
These days, the comic book owns pop culture. You'll find it all in the panel of your favorite comic book. Us, we're living the comic's life. We're Breaking the Panel.
Welcome to Breaking the Panel, your number one awesome sauce source for everything that is comic books. And we're getting ready for Dragon Con. I got so much cool Dragon Con news to tell everybody today. But first and foremost, big, big thank you to, well, I was about to call out your middle name just in honor, but I don't know if you want people to know that. So anyway, just Paul Klotz for holding down the fort last week.
Yeah, I did good.
Yeah, you did. You know what? The house is still standing. Nobody filed a sexual harassment lawsuit. I'm looking at you, Phil. But no, everything was good, man. It was awesome.
Yeah, we didn't swear like a million times this time either. That was good.
That's always awesome. And filling in for Chris Wisdom as he is out. You know, everybody keeps putting crap on the internet. He's out saving the world, so we're going to have this guest, Casey Straws. Like, no, that fool is probably playing paintball and picking his boogers in the desert is what he's doing. But you know what? We can say he's doing it for work, so there. But Chris Wisdom is being covered by none other than Trivial Warfare's own Carmella.
Hello, how are you?
You are awesome. Now, Carmella, we learned some amazing news today.
What's that?
Trivia Warfare is officially nominated in Games and Hobbies for the Podcast Award, the Academy of Podcasters Podcast Awards.
I know, it's really exciting. I heard about it today. Jonathan told everybody. We're like, what? What do you mean that we're nominated? So it's pretty cool. It's, we're up there with Good Job Brain.
So, and that show is, while it is captained by none other than Jonathan, who is an amazing guy and does some great work over there, it wouldn't be the same without you, Chris, and Ben. I mean, you four are the heart of the show.
I know.
So, now I'm wondering, because I'm sure there's only going to be one award, and if you win it, is Jonathan already called dibs, or are you going to share it between the four of you?
We may have to have a custody battle, but it'll probably end up in Jonathan's place. So
since you record there anyway, might as well, right?
Yeah, you know, I just come and visit it and, you know, pet it fondly. So,
well, I got to actually see the beautiful Carmella this weekend. Well, not in person, although they're only about 6 hours away from me. We did upcoming episodes. They record and then go through the production process. An upcoming episode of Trivial Warfare, I get to be the drunken, loudmouth host.
Yeah.
Oh, don't, yeah, y'all were louder than I was, but I was drunk, without a doubt. Is Trivial Warfare After Dark Uncensored?
Yeah, it was an experience.
Yeah. Yeah, it was an experience.
But we had a good time, and that's what matters. So.
Oh, it was so much fun. It was. So we'll definitely promote that. When it comes out, I'll let everybody know here as well. We'll promote it on our channels. So that's going to be fun. But first, now, let's jump into the email. Klotz, would you like me to read this, or you want to read the email? Okay, I'll read it, and you can respond first. Gentlemen and Charles, thank you, Frank. I appreciate you. Going back, listening to some old shows, and a topic you touched on. First off, this is from Frank Allen, esteemed friend of the show and one of the awesome hosts over at Toy Power on the Toy Power podcast. I think it might be toypower.com. Do I have to do the accent, Klotz? Toy Power. Power. I can't do it.
Yes. Yes, you have to.
It's horrible. I can't do it. We love Frank, and he was on the panel with Guardians of the Galaxy, so that was awesome. So this is Frank. He says, going back, a topic you touched on previously struck a chord with me, specifically the discussion about Rogue One and the now famous trailer shots that never made it into the final film. Along those lines, I want to branch that conversation into another medium, the world of gaming. The use of DLC and microtransactions in games is pretty much par for the course now. For the purposes of this conversation, I'm mainly referring to AAA titles on traditional platforms. Mobile gaming is its own beast. My example is the recently released Injustice 2 from NetherRealm Studios. More than a week before the game was released, they announced some DLC fighters would be available for purchase. This seems to make sense, as the game would have gone gold much earlier. However, I noticed when I went to the PlayStation Store, the download said DLC was tiny, 1 megabyte per character. This means that the code for the DLC is already on the damn disc that I paid for. To use a relatable example, so I'm going to stop here, what he's inferring is you're basically buying a key to unlock the character that's already coded in instead of an actual downloadable content.
Yep.
That's kind of, all right, I see why he's got his
I'll let you finish and then I'll respond.
Right. Yeah, you picked right. You're responding first is probably better. To use a relatable example, this is the equivalent of buying a bottle of scotch. Very good reference, as I have one sitting on my desk currently half empty. Something I do regularly is what he puts in here. Me too, sir. He says for $50. Well, you know, mine's about, actually in Australian dollars, that's about the same. Yeah, I pay 30 US, so 50 Australians, I think maybe about the same. But in order to drink the last two shots, something I also do quite regularly, I get told, I need to pay another $10. Name another industry that uses this kind of business model. Go on, I'll wait. Kotz, I'm looking just to you, man, because I can't.
Finish the damn letter. Then I'll respond.
Paying for something extra that is produced post-launch or buying in-game currency is one thing, but shelling out more to simply access something I already have in my digital hands is just plain greedy. To link it back to Rogue One, I can't help but wonder if this was a decision on behalf of WB execs or the marketing department. Were the developers told from above, hold back 3 finished characters for DLC, or was this always the plan at a design level? Either way, curious to hear the panel's thoughts on this kind of practices. Here, Klotz, I've dusted off the soapbox for you already. Frank.
Okay, a couple things. This is an issue in the wider gaming community. If you go on Reddit, for example, and go to the gaming and PC gaming subreddits, you'll see a lot of commentary about this sort of practice / behavior, along with some other, you know, more recent industry things like early access and all that kind of stuff. Hot button issue. The thing about DLC is DLC can be done a couple different ways. DLC can be done well, where it's like, if you're talking about like an RPG or an action game, it's a whole new quest area and all kinds of, there'll be a whole new area. There'll be a bunch of story and all that kind of stuff. In the case of Injustice 2, it's a fighting game. My understanding is that a couple of those characters, those DLC characters, are just reskins of existing characters. So like, for example,
that's not unusual for a game either.
Right. One of them is, the John Stewart version of Green Lantern. Another one was Power Girl version of Kara. You know, stuff like that. So,
sure.
I think some of those DLC characters already exist in the game because they're literally just, you know, alternate character reskins of them. And that is perfectly acceptable DLC, in my opinion. You know what I mean? Like, that's saying, listen, we put some people on this, some extra time and effort into making, you know, an alternate version or whatever, but it's optional. Like, you don't have to buy it if you don't want to. But if you'd like to kick us a couple extra bucks, here's an option to do so.
Well, okay, so like Borderlands 2, when it first came out, this is years ago now, because it's so old enough now that it's been on the free game for Xbox Gold, with Gold. Love the game, by the way. I'm still playing through it again for like the third time. But when I pre-ordered it, they encouraged pre-orders. Now, if you just bought the game, you get the standard 4 characters. Mm-hmm. But as of day one launch, if you pre-ordered, you would get another character that was ready to go, and then a few extra guns, right? Mm-hmm. Which the guns turned out to be actually a little pointless, but the character actually became my favorite character. So I was very happy with the pre-order. But it wasn't a DLC. It was, hey, this is to encourage you to spend a little extra money ahead of time.
Yeah, and that I don't mind so much, because I actually did end up getting the pre-order for that. And
yeah.
She's like,
did
one
you
of
get the
best characters.
Did you get the season pass as well?
Yeah, I did, because I played the hell out of the first Borderlands, so I knew it was going to do the second one. And so that one I didn't mind so much. day one DLC does bother me. So like, for example, when Dragon Age Origins first came out, and this was like in 09, they had a separate side quest that was already on the disc, but you had to go and pay for it because it wasn't part of your regular disc. So I was like, well, that's kind of lame. And of course, you know, I like to blame EA for everything, so I always say that's EA's fault. But, you know, DLC, when it's done really well, I don't mind paying for it. So, like, Oblivion, the Elder Scrolls Oblivion game kind of paved the way for what I think DLC can do. But things like Day 1 DLC, I think that's really lame. And, you know, just buying the key to unlock the code on the disc actually is pretty stupid. So,
yeah, that's... I'm with you.
There's definitely, like, yeah, if you're launching Day 1 DLC and it's not pure cosmetic stuff... people are going to call you on your bullshit. You know what I mean? They're going to say, well, it's done. Like, no, like put it in, you know what I mean? Put it in the game. You know, you mentioned Borderlands 2, Charles. That's a game that has some excellent DLC.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, Tiny Tina's D&D campaign.
Oh, I know, right?
Like one of the best things, you know, I mean, that might go down in history as one of the greatest examples of DLC ever.
And the beauty of the season pass was you got the first four DLCs, which Tiny Tina's, I think, was the last of the four. Mm-hmm. And you got an extra character. So for grand total, pre-ordering and season pass. So pre-order means I paid full price. So you're talking about $60 right. off the shelf. And then another $20 for the... So $80 got me two extra characters. One I was in love with. The other was okay. But four amazing packs, including the Tiny Tina's Dungeons & Dragons one is...
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they actually made two more packs you could download. Plus they did Adventurer packs where it upped the level. So you turn it up to 11. So instead of capping out at 50, you can go up to 61. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those kind of things. So I thought they handled it well, but on the flip side, Lego, not the newest Lego Batman, but the one before it, I pre-ordered and I got a stupid little Lex Luthor Lego, and that was it. I was like, no, I want in-game content, man. I mean, cool Legos, cool if I'm a collector. I'm not. I want in-game stuff.
Right.
Yeah. It's sometimes it's done well, sometimes it's not. One that comes to mind for me, Overwatch, you know, kind of talking about like what you're talking about there with a pre-order bonus. I pre-ordered the Origins edition of Overwatch so that I could get, the impression we were given early on was that all of the skins in the Origins edition would be like, you have to get that like early on and then those would just go away. Well, they just did their 1 year anniversary. They're in the middle of their 1 year anniversary event right now. And they have a an extreme edition or whatever they're calling it, or game of the year edition, that's right, that has those same skins in it. And it's so heavily discounted right now, a year later, that it's only like $30 for that version of it.
Yeah.
And I'm a little miffed. When I saw that, I was like, why did I buy? Because, you know, you could get Overwatch for $40 or $60 if you got the Origins edition. I was like, why did you milk me for an extra $20 at launch for some cosmetics that I thought would be exclusive and then just make them available later in your, you know, your all comprehensive version? Like that.
Yeah.
That rubs me the wrong way. That's like you basically implied that stuff would be exclusive. You said that even like you're like, you can't unlock it in game. You know, you could only get it through that option, you know? And so I was just kind of frustrated with that because, like, and then the other thing is that version of the game comes with 10 free loot boxes, too. And I'm like, you didn't give me 10 free loot boxes when I bought the Origins edition when I paid $60 a year ago.
Yeah.
You know?
I find a lot of games are trending in that direction. A few years ago, there was a collector's edition for a game I was playing. And I didn't buy that one because I was like, oh, it's got some stuff in it. And those things are cool, but, you know, I'm not going to spend the extra $30 to get the special edition. And then about a year or so later, I'm on looking at downloadable content for this game, and it's a discounted price for those, you know, exclusive pieces of content that were in the collector's edition. So I was like, oh, well, they're $5 now, I'll buy them. But I do find that games do that a lot, and that's kind of me too.
Well, okay, so exclusive doesn't always mean forever and ever, amen.
True.
Right.
Put Randy Travis, but I've noticed with... Games Now, of course, I bought the Borderlands. I registered it, both versions, on my Xbox to my Live account. And being that I have an Xbox One and I don't have the disc anymore, when it went to the free one, I took the opportunity to add it to my digital library for free. Mm-hmm. Thinking, okay, I'll just start with the four basic characters. It gave me everything that I had owned before. It did not give me the extra two missions I had not purchased yet, but it kept track of what I'd pay for. Some games, though, that I've never touched, mm-hmm. I can't remember one off the top of my head. But once it, now, of course, when you're talking about games with gold, you're talking about a game that's 4, 5, 6 years old.
Right.
Right. And they give it away for free for 2 weeks, roughly, out of the month. But I've gotten a game or two from them that came basically like it was a collector's edition. It had all the extra maps and skins and, like... Now, 4 years old, now I'm going to ask you two, because you two are hotter and closer to this than I am. Mm-hmm. At 4 years, not the 1 year that you just mentioned, but at 4 years or older, are you mad that it's not exclusive anymore, or is that okay?
No, I think that's fine, because at that point, the majority of the hardcore gamers that were playing it at launch have played it. They may still be playing it, I mean, because you and I are still playing Borderlands, and it's been out
right.
for years. But I think at that point, it's just kind of... not really gone past its game cycle, but it's close enough to the end of its cycle that I don't think it matters anymore. But that's just me, so I'm not sure about plots.
Well, you see, now this is, it's a tricky issue, in particular because we're dealing with this, I've been playing Warframe a lot lately again, and we're dealing with this in Warframe in the fact that when that game first came out, they did a Founders bundle, where there are various levels of it, but basically there was an exclusive prime version of the main, like, poster child Warframe character, basically, where it was an, you know, an up, it has upgraded stats and it has a unique look that's only available with the prime version. And they've primed a lot of, you know, over a dozen of the other Warframes since then, but that one is still only available to those early founders. And there's a couple weapons as well, depending on how far you went with how much you wanted to spend. And the thing is, like, there's a little bit of character level progression that's tied to those. That's called mastery rank, because you get mastery for maxing out all the weapons and Warframes in the game and stuff. So there's okay. a little bit of, like, progression XP that's locked behind that, but it's not a big deal. It's not enough to keep people from catching up to the highest level right now, but it's, like, there's some people who are agitated by that. But the big thing, like, for me has been the developer, the creative director has said on stream before, he goes, you know, we kind of made a mistake with that because we made that, we promised that we would never release it again. Like, it was, if you were a founder and you bought that, that was it. And he's like, at the time, we thought we'd get maybe a year to 18 months out of our game. Because it's a free-to-play shooter, you know what I mean? And
right.
It's kind of a grindy farming game. And he's like, we had no idea we'd still be sitting here 4 or 5 years later. And it seems like such a mistake because that character is iconic. It's, you know, it's the character for the, like, the main poster child for the whole game. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people feel like it kind of sucks that you can't get the best version of the main character of the game, who's just a generically good character. You know what I mean? The beauty of that game is that, like, most of the characters are viable. Like, you can you build your loadout based around what you want to play. You know what I mean? You play with the weapons you want to play with. You play with the warframes you want to play with.
Yeah.
And almost all of them are good enough to be played in almost anything you want to use them for. There's a few exceptions. But in this case, it's like, it's just this really limited thing. And it's like, on one hand, I completely understand why they want to honor their promise. But on the other hand, a lot of the founders who have that have said, you know, honestly, I wouldn't be that upset if you released it. Like, just find a way to make it so that I still have something that's noteworthy that separates me from the rest of the pack, but, like, maybe don't restrict in-game content from other people.
Yeah.
Maybe keep some stuff strictly cosmetic for us.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you added a cosmetic patch or a certain shoulder plate or some piece of armor or something that was...
Yeah, some badge or something.
Yeah, that's cosmetic. It says, I'm a founder... And I get
and they do have some of that stuff. They have a unique in play, you know, in-game icon for their, you know, their player icon, which can be used as a spray, and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, so it's definitely one of those things. It's a tough call because, like, with with Overwatch, I was like, I bought this because I thought I wouldn't be able to get these skins any other way, and I really like them. And then and I'm upset that you just tacked them onto your Game of the Year edition later on.
Yeah.
So I've been on both sides of it, and I can see both sides of the whole thing. I think what's really important is that developers be very clear with what they're doing, you know what I mean? And I think day one DLC, like, to get back to what Frank's talking about here, because we've gotten way off topic, but to get back to what Frank's kind of talking about here, I think it's really important that day one DLC be mostly cosmetic type stuff. You shouldn't be locking content away right away. You know what I mean? If you want to add characters later on down the road, and, you know, characters to fight with, and you want to add maybe new levels or something like that, depending on what kind of game it is later on, it completely makes sense to release it for 3-4 months down the road, 6 months down the road, whatever. Because that's optional content, and that's only going to be something that's alluring to people who are still sticking with the game. You know what I mean?
Yes.
But day one, it definitely feels like they're grasping for more. And games aren't cheap. But, you know, $60 expected price on most AAA games these days, that's, you know, that's a hefty sum. You know what I mean? You got to hope for a lot of entertainment to get a good return on your investment there. And not all games, you know, hold up to that. Like, in the last year or two, we've had some really big examples where stuff like that's fallen flat. In particular, No Man's Sky. Made big promises and came up really short. Right. You know, I mean, people were done with that game in a day or two. They're like, oh, I did literally all the things I could do. And they're like, I don't feel like I got my money's worth at all. And on the flip side, there's lots of games out there now, especially some of the free-to-play options. Like, they might be kind of grindy, but they promise you months, if not years, of content. You know, like, there's stuff for you to do forever. So you gotta find a way to kind of definitely navigate that whole thing. Some companies,
yes, again, going back to the company that makes Borderlands 2, I have it in my head. I can't put it on the tip of my tongue right now. Gearbox?
Yep. Gearbox, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gearbox. They planned ahead, man. Now, there's three Borderlands games. The first two are by Gearbox. The third one is a pre-sequel, so it's in between 1 and 2. Keeps the humor of the game with the title, right?
Yep.
But it was done by a company in Australia, and not Gearbox. And I don't know if Gearbox is working on Official 3, but even today, I was like, you know what? I know these little scroll ads at the bottom when you log in, their announcements and whatever. And I'm like, I imagine these are just pre-programmed on a server. But I'm going to check it out. Sure enough, I went to their Twitter where it says get golden keys, which unlocks a special chest and the thing that you can do over and over again is epic weapons. Mm-hmm. And I went to their Twitter 2 weeks ago, and they put up new golden key codes. I was like, what? This is awesome. And they are continuously, and that's how they're engaging their audience. They're making money, as far as I can tell, because they're not having to put out a new game and new development. They're just putting out new codes and keeping people in the game because they built a great game and they supported it and they built a great community. And
yeah, I mean, they've been, since Borderlands 2 came out, they've released shift codes on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Right along.
You know, I just kind of figured that they would sunset it, right? I mean, you're talking a good 4 or 5 years now.
There's still lots of people who enjoy playing it.
Yeah. I do too. I mean, you heard me talk about it. But I just assumed, okay, it's now hitting the free market essentially. So they sunset the cool stuff in the game. I'll just play it. No, they're out there.
So that's not always necessarily the case. When you see something offered through PS Plus or Xbox Gold for free, that's usually because that parent company of the service approached the developer and said, would you like to offer your game? Because the big one that stands out to me was not this past holiday season, but the holiday season before it, when Rocket League hit PS Plus. That was huge for that game because they were a relatively small game that had a huge, like, they had exploded. You know what I mean? Like, people were talking about how great this game was. It was multi-platform. It was a lot of fun. And then all of a sudden, Sony, and they've talked about this. Like, I watched a great GDC talk where they talked about the fact that Sony approached them and said, would you like to feature your game as a PS Plus free game? And they, you know, there's a relationship there. They pay them for that. A certain amount, you know what I mean?
There's a little bit, right?
But, you know, in a game like Rocket League, they hope to make some money back on microtransactions with loot crate keys and stuff like that. But the thing was, the exposure that they got from that was so huge, you know what I mean? By being offered at that point, and it was so early in the game. You know what I mean? Like, the game had only been out a few months at that point, and it just it contributed to an explosion of popularity. And that game is still wildly successful, you know, almost 2 years later now. And that's a small developer that gets really highlighted by something like that. So yeah. It's not always, you know, a bad thing if you see it available as a free game on there, because it's not saying that the game is like out of date all the time.
Right.
Sometimes they're really, and that game's only a $20 game normally too. You know what I mean? Without any of the DLC, without any of the DLC options. So, but that was a pretty big deal for them. But yeah, no, it's a thing. You know?
Yeah. I've always seen it as a promotion for something about to come out. Like Tomb Raider, the reboot, was released free on the system about 3 months before Rise of the Tomb Raider was to be released.
Right.
And it worked on me. I mean, I pre-ordered it as soon as I finished Tomb Raider. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I see it, yeah, definitely as advertisement. I know some of the stuff I don't really play, like Forza, I'll download it just to see the graphics and handling. And I know they're selling the skins and the DLCs and stuff, that they'll make their money there as well. But good question, Frank. Thank you for writing in. And everybody, check out Toy Power. It's an amazing show. And as far as his analogy goes, if anybody tells me I have to pay $10 to finish off the two shots in the bottom of my bottle, they better watch out, man. Daddy likes the scotch. Today, Paul Klotz, you know what I've been talking about more than anything else when I talk to you this year?
Dragon Con,
man. We are planning. We're doing all kind of wheels turning, and what can we do that's going to be awesome this year. And fortunately, for the first time, I get to be on the inside officially this year and help do some things there. And we got the official go-ahead Sunday night of Dragon Con. That should be September 3rd. I don't have my calendar in front of me, but I believe that's the Sunday night of the Labor Day weekend is when it is. September 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, I believe, is the dates. Sunday night, the 3rd, will be officially giant size team up night. We'll be doing back-to-back live shows of all the shows that are on the network, except for Travis Jones, unfortunately. He has to leave Sunday, so he'll do his earlier. He will still do a live show. It'll just be at a different time earlier in the con. But if you're making plans to come to Dragon Con, and you should, plan to stick around Sunday night and hang out and do all the shows. We got Pokemon Go, of course. Breaking the Panel is going to – I think Pokemon Go is going to kick it off, because we're a little more newsy and downplayed. And then Breaking the Panel will get in there, and they'll be swearing. There will be swearing on that Breaking the Panel. It just happens at Dragon Con. And then we're just going to move all the way up to we hit Booze and Phasers and Botched to end the night with heavy drinking and dirty humor. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
So my understanding – based on last week's episode when we had Phil from Botch guesting, is that Phil does intend to make it.
Yeah, he talked about that, but I don't know that's
going to work. Last week he promised me, so I'm putting this out there to hold him to it.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold your breath.
Nah. But, you know, it's definitely going to be an exciting chance for everybody to get together, hang out. You know, you folks at home, you know, if you turn up, say hello, you know, we'll get to hang out.
Dude,
a bit.
It's gonna be, awesome. So Klotz has done panels. I'm assuming you've done more than just a panel we did at SUNY Poly.
I've done a couple panels,
yeah. Here. So you understand when you get in front of an audience, the energy level goes up anyway. When you record a show, and Carmella,
I crank it all the way down to one.
oh, I'm gonna bring a taser then, Caliprod, get you going. And Carmella, you know, when you record over Skype or something else separated versus being in the same room with people,
yeah,
the energy level goes up. So you put all of us together in the same room for the first time ever, and then you put us on a panel in front of Dragon Con. It's gonna be out there. It's gonna be fun. It's gonna be rock and roll is what it's gonna be. So everybody should definitely come. Tickets are very reasonable. You can get a one-day pass, and each day is a different price because Saturday is the most popular day. I think Monday's the cheapest day because it's a half day, but Sunday's like the next cheapest. Four-day pass at full price is $180, and you get access to everything with that pass. So you can go see your William Shatner panel, and then you can come see Breaking the Panel. That'd be awesome.
Don't go see Bill Shatner. Come see us. I mean, don't get me wrong, like,
okay. No, at our time of night, there's going to be no big panels competing with us.
Oh, good.
Usually the big stuff is before 5. We're going to start about 5 or 6.
Because we're the main attraction, right?
That's right. I about said something, but
don't say
right.
that. Like, don't go to DragonCon and be like, I'm here for the main attraction with giant size team up, because people are going to look at you like, giant size who?
No, absolutely say it. And you're like, oh, you don't know? And then you just turn away laughing and walk away and see if they follow you.
Yeah, yeah. Sprinkle a little mysticism on it. Be like, oh, you don't know. Muggle. And just walk away. It, don't forget to wear your Weasley Brothers shirts. Those will be important, you know?
That'll be important. But speaking of cons, the Phoenix Comic Con just ended. And they had a really bizarre thing happen at Phoenix Comic Con. And the headline reads, Power Rangers star targeted by gunman dressed as a Punisher. And the thing is, this guy literally believed, or at least he says he believes, that he's the real-life incarnation of the Punisher. And he was arrested with 4 firearms, several knives, body armor. I'm looking what they're charging him with.
Attempted murder, resisting arrest, here. And aggravated assault.
Yeah. And they actually threw on, because wearing, apparently, at least in Phoenix, I don't know if this is national or not, but wearing body armor during the commission of a felony adds to the charges there. But of course, all cons are no weapons allowed, right?
Right.
What's up?
No, I'm just laughing at the fact that body armor adds to the severity of the crime. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, don't be safe. don't be safe while you commit your felonies.
Like if you're gonna be stupid about it, be stupid about it.
Yeah, like commit fully, like all or nothing, brother. Like no.
So he targeted Jason David Frank, and that's how. And that's how he referenced him. So he's not targeting a fictional character of what did he play? The Black Ranger?
He was the Green Ranger. He was Tommy.
Green Ranger. Sorry.
He's like the only one of the original Rangers that's at like every Comic Con ever.
Yeah. He's not the Scotch Ranger. I don't care.
Scotch.
He was the Green Ranger, then he was the White Ranger, and then he was the Red Ranger. So
yeah, JDF is Power Rangers royalty. Okay.
Yes.
No, I did figure that out.
He was on the most. He was in the first movie. He was on the most. You know, most shows, independent seasons, and everything. When people talk about Power Rangers, JDF is like first and foremost. Because that's the other thing too, is he's been a guy who's embraced that fandom so much. Like he loves that people love him for Power Rangers, and he loves the people that love Power Rangers. Like he really like. I saw him at Philly Comic Con a few years ago. He was awesome. I saw him on one side panel, and then I saw him host the cosplay contest that they had at the end of the day on Sunday, and he was phenomenal. Like, he was high energy, he was engaged, he was having a good time with everybody. This is a guy who does the full circuit, like, all the time. You know what I mean?
We should have him on breaking the panel, then.
Well, I mean, good luck. I don't know. I mean, we're not writing checks to our
guests. Wouldn't that be something, you know, how they have the news circuit, right? Where if they're announcing a movie, they call certain radio stations, and if you get on the list, you're... What if we became like the Comic-Con circuit show? Like, you do all the cons, and at the end of the year, you call Breaking the Panel, talk about your year, and that's the end of your calendar year.
I think I would question the sanity of everybody who like decided that we were the destination to promote your Comic-Con.
I'm just saying it, man. Like, it just takes a JDF to make it happen.
In any case, though, this is a crazy story, man. Like,
yeah.
You can't write this shit. Like, Hollywood... Yeah, this should be like a Law and Order episode or something. Law and Order's off air, but like, you know, one of those shows.
Yeah.
This should be a police procedural plot.
He later posts a video message on Facebook saying that even though it looks like things don't faze me, and I read this quote particularly because I'll tell you what I'm saying, but even though things look like it doesn't faze me, I refuse to have a situation tear me apart mentally. You got to remember, things could always be worse. Things could have been worse, but it wasn't. You know, everyone is safe and things are okay, and it's a great thing. I love that because I've seen so many stars use this kind of thing for attention, and not to call out certain things that have happened recently in the news, because that's possibly a whole different situation. I don't know. But when something like this happens, all of a sudden, like, oh, I can never go to another Comic-Con again because I don't want to put anybody in danger. No, you're playing to the press and trying to keep your name up there in the trending charts.
Sure.
Right. And so I'm glad that he didn't blame himself, which is some people do that. and he didn't lash out. He handled it professionally, and it was great.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad he's safe. I'm glad everybody's safe. I'm glad this man was caught before anything horrible could happen. It would have been kind of awesome if JDF, like, karate kicked him or something. No, I'm kidding. Obviously, if you're the target of a brutal plot like this, you really shouldn't try to be the one that defuses or defends yourself.
Right. That's why you have handlers.
jokes, people. Jokes, I promise. Yes. Yeah, no, I mean, so, you know, clearly... The gentleman, and I use gentleman very loosely, the gentleman who perpetrated this crime can't be entirely in his right mind because he really does think he's the Punisher, at least he claims to be.
Right.
So, you know, it highlights a couple of things. You know, JDF points out that this is an opportunity to look at security. You know, that I agree with that because I've been to a couple cons and there's so many people at a con. And especially with cosplaying and everything, you know, it can be really tough. And I feel bad for cosplayers because, you know, this is going to impact them in a big way. You know, because costumes and props are going to get, like, for the remainder of the show there, they banned prop weapons. And there's some cosplay where a prop weapon is, like, absolutely essential. You know,
right.
What I mean?
That,
like,
is most of the cost. Really.
Yeah, you know, like if there's a couple of characters, you know, there's a handful of characters out there that just don't look right. Like Deadpool doesn't look right if he doesn't have swords on his back. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't look like Deadpool. You know,
he looks like a dude in a romper.
And there's a couple other examples too. There's a couple examples of characters that are popular and really exciting to see people cosplay that have a weapon as part of their identity. You know, so yeah, this is gonna you know, lead to crackdown standards, I think, for cosplaying at most cons.
I'm curious to see what they do with Dragon Con, but Carmella, what were you saying?
Oh, I was just laughing at your comment.
The bromper. I'm with you, Klotz, and you'll see at Dragon Con, security is difficult because you're talking about five hotels.
Mm-hmm.
Wait. Yeah, five hotels spread out is 3 blocks wide and 2 blocks deep. So that's the square radius, if you will, of where you're going. So there's always cosplay everywhere. You're going in and out of hotels. And only in certain areas where you can access the celebrities directly. There's one hotel across from where we're going to be most of the time at the Hilton. Hilton is where the podcast track is, so you'll see us there. But across the street is the Marriott. And in the basement of the Marriott is where they do the authors signing. And, of course, anywhere there's a celebrity photo opportunity or signing, you can't get there without your badge, right? You have to prove you're a paid member. And that's where you'll get the most security. But there's plenty of – now, there are plenty of police officers around. There are plenty of security guards around. But a lot of times the doors are monitored by volunteers or staff of the con.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just – I mean, you're talking about 80,000 people.
Yeah.
In 6 square blocks-ish. So it's a lot of people. It's tough, and they do crack down on where the most danger would be, like where Green Ranger would be. Mm-hmm. is fairly secure. You have to go through, if I'm remembering right, you have to go through basically 2 levels of security to even get in there. One at the front door, and then one at the actual hall door where you go. And they check bags. They won't let you in with a bag and those kind of things either.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but it's what can you do? And if you have to crack down from that,
I would expect that if you're looking to go to a signing or something like that with someone who's particularly famous, if you're planning to hit any cons this year, including Dragon Con or any others, start planning for a little bit of extra time to get there because you're probably going to have to go through increased security checks and that kind of thing. Yeah. And if you don't have to have something with you, don't bring it. You know what I mean? I'm reminded of my at Philly Comic Con, my roommate bought one of those really fancy lightsabers that you can pick all the, you know, there's a company there that builds it and they have all the different options, and he bought one of those and like he kind of wanted to walk around with it because it's like he just spent several hundred dollars on this this prop, and it was like it was really inconvenient though because he was bumping into people with it all the time and stuff like that. And he ended up not bringing it the other days because he realized pretty quickly that it causes problems. So I would say like anything like that, anything you think that's going to slow you down, especially if you're doing a you know, a celebrity signing or something like that, first of all, I know you're paying money for that. Like those.
Oh,
always,
yeah.
Those always cost a mountain of money. So don't, you know, don't bring anything and don't do anything. Don't act in a weird way that's going to somehow impact your investment in that experience. Do, you know, kind of look at it like people who travel a lot for work do if they fly a lot. Make it as smooth as possible. You know what I mean?
Now, Carmela, are you a con girl? Do you like to go to cons a lot?
I actually haven't been to any. I wanted to go to MegaCon this past weekend, but I wasn't able to. But I haven't actually been to any, no.
Well, maybe you should make some plans to come see us at Dragon Con.
Yeah, we'll yeah, I should come to Dragon Con. I mean, it's only a few hours.
And girls have it much tougher than guys at a con. They get groped quite often in the crowds, and it's not cool, man.
Yeah.
so. But, you know, what is cool is what you brought to the table here. You seem to love this DC Bombshells. Tell us about that.
Bombshells. So DC Bombshells is a comic series, but it started out as just somebody redrawing DC female DC characters as pinups from the 1940s. And so they kind of made it into this like collector statuette kind of series. And then they built a comic out of it. So it's like how Transformers started as toys, and then they made it into a TV show. Kind of the same idea. So in 2015, it's written by a woman. Her name's Marguerite Bennett. And basically, it's an alternative history of World War II. And so it's got Wonder Woman, and Amanda Waller makes an appearance. She kind of looks like Bessie Coleman, if you know who Bessie Coleman is. Do you know who Bessie Coleman is?
The Riveter, right?
No, that's Rosie. Bessie Coleman. Bessie Coleman was the first woman of color to hold a pilot's license. So if you look at her, she's pretty much modeled after her.
Gotcha.
So Batwoman. There's no Batman in the storyline. He's not part of that universe. Aquaman eventually makes an appearance, but it's really based around all of the female characters in DC's universe, and I think it's really awesome.
Yeah, and it says, I got the wiki, dc.wikia.com link for the show notes, and it says Aquawoman, Mera, is there, Amanda Waller, like the Batwoman, Kate Kane.
Yeah.
The question is Renee Montoya, which I find very interesting. Stargirl, Courtney Duganova, I can't say it.
Duganova.
Supergirl, of course, Kara, but Starikov instead of.
She comes in from the Russian side of things.
Yeah. So does that kind of make her a bad guy? Girl,
not necessarily. The Russians weren't really totally bad people in World War II. It wasn't until we got into the Cold War.
They were our ally. Yeah, that's right. They were our ally.
So they're coming in from that side of things. Zatanna is being kind of held captive and forced to do magic for the Joker's daughter. So she plots with John Constantine to escape and all those other stuff.
This is cool, and it is available on DC Universe Online as well.
It is, and I usually wait for the trade paperback so that way I can get a bunch of them at once. Volume 3 just came out in March, and Volume 4 will be coming out at the end of June. So there's definitely a lot of material out there if you're interested in taking a look at it.
And the artwork definitely looks really good.
Oh, yeah. I bought the art book for myself for Christmas. That was my gift to myself. I even wrapped it and everything. I'm like, this is my gift to myself. And I'm going to unwrap this at Christmas.
Nice. We're going from something that looks awesome to something that looks crazy weird. I stumbled across this today in searching for stuff, and I'm honestly very excited about this. Deadpool the Duck. And the first issue cover art is just, I love it. It's so horrible. I love it, though. And here's the write-up on Marvel.com. What do you get when you take one cynical anthropomorphic duck named Howard and cross him with the mouthiest mercenary in the Marvel Universe? Deadpool the Duck, that's what. When Wade Wilson accepts a mission from S.H.I.E.L.D. to capture a high-profile E.T., the snatch and grab turns out to be much more complicated than he anticipated. One unfortunate wrong place at the wrong time accident leaves Deadpool and Howard fighting for control of their shared body. That's the cutest merc in the Marvel Universe has ever seen. But how is nefarious megacorporation Roxxon mixed up in all this? And what about Rocket Raccoon, Can Howard and Deadpool work together to get their own bodies back, or will Wade forever be trapped in a duck he never made? Wade makes ducks? What? I don't understand.
Like, he didn't make his target or something, maybe?
Maybe. Deadpool, the Duck, issues number 1 through 5. The first one just published May 31st. It doesn't say here if it's going to be monthly or bi-monthly, but Klotz, you had some very loving things to say about this.
You would like this.
I don't know. I would read it.
Okay, I'm not the biggest Howard the Duck fan, all okay. right? So let that be known. So I wish you guys the greatest of enjoyment from this, but I will pass.
I'm mostly reading it because of Deadpool, to be quite honest. But
that's fair.
I like what I've read of Howard the Duck. I enjoyed the books that I read with him in it.
Howard the Duck just breaks immersion in the setting for me. It's funny because, like, Rocket Raccoon doesn't, but Howard the Duck does.
Well, nobody reacts to Howard. Howard is normal. Like, Howard is treated as if you walked up to me to say, hey. Mm-hmm. Nobody bats an eye at Howard, but Rocket Raccoon, everybody's like, are you a raccoon? What is that? Why is he walking around here? So I think that may be part of the difference for you there.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but yeah, Carmelo and I, we got this one.
We'll read it. We'll tell you how it goes.
Awesome.
All right, well, you know how it goes. We're going to play an ad or two here for you. We're going to say thanks for listening. We'll be back with some really cool news and some interesting discussion coming up. So stay tuned after the break. We'll be back. And we're back, just like that. So the Marvel Universe, this was interesting. This was fun. Australia, of course, is hitting more of my radar now because I've been listening to Toy Power. And they did a really interesting episode on how taxes are being changed in Australia and how it affects the collecting community. And I thought, when I saw the title of it, it's a local issue. I don't think I'll be that interested, but I'm going to give it a shot because it's Frank and I want to hear what the show's about. Listen to every last minute of it. They discuss things very well on that show. And they really related it in simple terms to how it affect the market and collecting toys and books and everything else. Well, other things have popped up on my radar from Australia, radar from Australia recently. But this one is by far one of the coolest. Here I got it open. The Marvel Universe gets the fine arts treatment at Australia's GOMA. And I'm going to tell you what GOMA stands for here. And it's the Queensland Gallery of Modern Art in Brisbane, Australia. They're going to have artwork, costumes, props, as well as never-before-seen items from the upcoming movie Thor Ragnarok. This is the first-of-its-kind museum show that apparently is accompanying the Australian Cinematheque's salute to Marvel, screening 16 movies. It doesn't say what time period, so I'm hoping that's over a week. But it over 500 things, man. But it's going to have Thor's hammer, Captain America's shield, Iron Man's armor, 150 props, drawings, cover art. I would love to go to this this exhibit at the art museum. What do you got? I know, Carmela, you're an artist yourself.
I am. I would definitely love to go and see this because, I mean, I do, you know, people always argue what's art, what's not art, are video games art. I definitely think those things are art. They invoke some sort of feeling in people, so I truly believe it's art. And I mean, I would just stare at Captain America's shield for hours.
I would just stare at his pecs for hours.
That's also true.
Klotz, I thought you were gonna be. That's fair. That's fair.
Well, no, you're not talking about Aquaman.
Hey, Jason Momoa is gorgeous. Okay.
Yeah, no, we've talked about that. I've acknowledged that.
Yeah, I'm almost afraid if I were ever to come across him in real life to make eye contact.
Oh yeah.
Because I just his brain might punch my brain and that's the end of me.
He's a big dude.
You don't want to make eye contact because you might fall in love.
Well, there's that too.
Let's be real. I mean,
well, let's be real. The first time I saw him on Stargate Atlantis, I fell in love. So,
been keeping that flame lit for some time.
No, if they ever carried this exhibit over to the U.S., I would definitely try and make a point to go see it because I think that would be awesome.
Yeah, we've got a great museum in Atlanta called the High Museum, which is also a great title. But it's they do a lot of exhibits. I mean, they would be able to handle this kind of exhibit is really, I guess, what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. Not every museum, of course, is set up for it, but I would love to see it come to the U.S. for sure. And I would, that'd be the one thing my wife would not have to drag me to at the museum. Like, no, I'm in line before you. Let's go see this. Klotz, would you go? I think New York, Natural History Museum, that's Chicago. But New York
or something would probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm reminded of, about 15 years ago now. No, it was 13 years ago. It was 2004. I went to Boston because they had a Lord of the Rings exhibit at one of the art museums out there.
Nice.
Where they had, like, you know, a lot of the concept art, and then also, you know, obviously tons of props from the film. And I love that stuff. Like, I'm a big fan of world building and a big fan of character design. Like, I find that really interesting. A lot of times I get pulled into franchises and stuff, not just because of the quality of the stories, but often also because of the quality of the character and world design. So I find that stuff fascinating. I would love to see an awesome exhibit on it.
And how they're doing it, it's not just the exhibit. Apparently, GOMA houses the Australian Cinematheque. And, of course, it's regularly screening the cycle of Marvel movies throughout this whole, I guess, throughout the whole time it's there. So, basically, as the credits roll, you watch a film, and you leave, and you empty out right into the exhibit space. And you get to see the actual props and and different things as you come out of that experience of watching the movie.
Yeah.
That's a whole nother level, man.
Mm-hmm.
That is great. So, Frank, it is your duty to go and see this and report back to us.
Is he in Australia?
Oh, yeah. Frank is on. I don't care if he's on the wrong side of Australia. You're closer than I am. It is your duty to go.
Yeah. And it's probably going to be his response. He's going to be like, you know, we have a continent, right? Like, whole continent.
And it's like my friend in Rhode Island. Like, hey, you know that other guy that's in Rhode Island, right? There's only like three of you. So
that's a little more fair. Rhode Island.
Okay, Rhode Island. Yeah. There's a... Well, I think, to be honest, too, for any of the three of us here, if this is only going to be in a museum that was 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours away from us, we might make the. I mean, 5-6 hours, that's an overnight trip, right? So that's a little stretching it, but I would probably do it. Yeah.
I could see taking, you know, something that's like less than a 10-hour drive. If it's only going to be in a couple places. Like, that's one of the things about living in upstate New York that is really fortunate, mm-hmm. is that the city is only about 5 hours away from me. Boston's only about six, you know? So if something is in the Northeast, there's a pretty good chance I can get to it relatively quickly and make a day of it, a long day of it, or make
or a cheap hotel room.
Or an overnight or a weekend of it. Yeah. And that's exactly what we did with that Lord of the Rings exhibit. I'm also reminded of, there was a Harry Potter installation in New York City when my sister, spent some time working in Manhattan, and so I went to visit her one time, and we went to that, and that was a lot of fun too. Anything like that is almost always worth the trip. Like, they're usually very well done, and there's just so much cool little stuff that, like, I know we have the internet, you know, and there's like anything you want to find out is on the internet. There's pictures of stuff, but it's so cool to be able to go see things in person, particularly art stuff, you know, and if they include costuming and all that and props and all that stuff, being able to see that stuff up close is like, it's totally worth it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, support your local museums, you know.
True. I mean, yes, definitely do that. If I was already going to Australia for something, like if I was going to Sydney, I'd make a point to go over to Brisbane and go see this. But unfortunately, I'm not doing that. So we have to have someone go look at it for us.
If I was going to Australia, I'd also take the opportunity to capture a Genghis Khan on Pokemon Go. That's apparently me. I'm one of the few people in the world still doing it. So. Nerd!
You're a nerd. Nobody likes you.
So here's what I love about early stories, right? People, I came across an article today that I got to, it's like 10 things that the Venom movie needs to do to get it right. I'm like, all right, clickbait, but maybe you'll inspire me. Because sometimes those things, some of the choices bring up great discussion points for us to jump on and talk about. Mm-hmm. Nope, I got to point five, and they actually got something totally wrong in how the films went. I mean, like, I'm the filthy casual. I mean, Chris and you, Klotz, call me out all the time on my lack of knowledge of remembrance of movies. And I knew this, whatever he was saying was wrong. Like, now I can't even read this article anymore. But I thought, since there's really no news on this thing, other than there's a Venom movie, it's got Tom Hardy as Venom, or Eddie Brock, I guess, rather. And it's got the director from Zombieland, which I absolutely love the crap out of Zombieland. What do we feel about Venom? Where do we want it to go? And are we as an individual thought process, are we excited about it?
I think it very much depends on what kind of Venom film they're looking to make. Are they looking to play up the savagery angle, so therefore they're going to make it kind of an intense, you know, action film? Or are they looking to play up the kind of comedic side of Venom? I think, obviously, with the Zombieland director, he's proven that he can do action comedy pretty well.
Yeah.
And so doing something like that would be cool. And in contrary to what show friend Casey Straws said online recently, I think it would be flipping fantastic if Carnage...
He needs to be the bad guy.
...was in that film and was the bad guy.
Yeah.
Because honestly, all right, so here's the thing. Venom was a flop in Spider-Man 3. Like, that was...
Venom was horrible.
It was really... I mean, there are people who say that that ended... Oh, I can't remember his name right now, the actor.
Topher Grace.
Tobey Maguire.
Topher Grace.
Topher.
No, there are people who argue that that film and that role took a huge chunk out of Topher Grace's career. Like,
he could have. It didn't end it.
He was on the trajectory to be mainstream A-lister. Like, everybody was going to see all of his movies forever. And then that film, You know what
he
I mean?
He was no Eddie Brock. I mean, he was just the wrong role for Eddie Brock.
Well, that's the thing too. Like, if you look at the characterization of Brock over the years, he's always been kind of a meathead. He's a built football player type guy. You know what I mean?
And he's lovable, like Travis Jones.
Yeah, and you pick this scrawny kid. You know, it was just miscasting, and plus he didn't play it right. He got the arrogance right. I did appreciate what they were going for with that, but they really needed to go for something different.
Well, the writing in that whole movie was just awful anyway, so
two really great villains, Sandman and Venom. Put them both, either one of those could have been the A-list bad guy
right.
to take the whole film. You put two of them in there, which waters it down. And then you did it so poorly. I love Thomas Hayden Church and a lot of things. 3,000 Miles of Graceland would probably get me disowned by Klotz, but I do love him in that movie. but no, he was just not a good Sandman. And neither one of them ever felt powerful.
No.
And now the one thing this article did say, and I don't have the link. I don't remember where it was. This is a clickbait article. But one of the things that the writer did say that I'll give anonymous credit to him because I don't know where the link is that there was too much CG for Venom. Way too much. Is that when he was in Venom, there was nothing corporeal to him. And while CG has come a long way since then,
right?
You still need like the Hulk. You can still see Mark Ruffalo in the Hulk when they're doing the CG. And if I'm not mistaken, Klotz, and please do correct me if I'm wrong, Mark Ruffalo did all the motion capture for the Hulk.
From what I understand.
So the mannerisms he has as Bruce Banner translate, and it gives that mind gap, that mind bridge, that he goes, oh, that's a real thing.
The one you really want to point to when you talk about mocap and CGI and doing it right.
Tarkin?
No.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Smaug from the Hobbit films. As bad as those films ended up being as a whole, everybody has agreed that, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch did an amazing job as Smaug. And if you look at the video, he did all the mocap. I mean, have him in this room and he's gyrating on the floor and acting out every single... It's amazing. He sold it 1,000%. Like, he was like, I'm doing this. Like, he didn't... You know, he took his pride, set it aside, and really acted the crap out of that. And I think that's what you need, is you need somebody who's willing to commit. And I firmly believe, you know, that Tom Hardy is a bit of a method actor. I don't want to go so far as to say that he's a full-blown method actor.
I know people have given him grief. I honestly loved his Bane. I did. I enjoyed his Bane.
Bane was just... That film had a lot of problems.
The film had some issues. It did. I disagree that Bane was one of them. I thought Bane was one of the shining moments of the film.
Tom Hardy in general is pretty great. So I actually have a little bit of confidence that they're going to have Tom Hardy do this time.
Yeah, I love Tom Hardy. Almost everything I've ever seen him in, he's been fantastic. He's been particularly good. Peaky Blinders, he was great on that. You know, some other stuff he's done recently, obviously Mad Max, that was great. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, a lot of people pan him for that Mad Max performance, but I'm like, no, that's probably the most accurate Max we'll ever get. You know, he's just a wild man. You know, he's been out in these chaotic, to say the least, environment for so long. But yeah, no, so I think Tom Hardy will do a stellar job. I think he'll commit 100%. He'll, you know, really try to do the best that he can. So now it's a question of building a story around that works, and building, you know, compelling villain that works with that. You know what I mean? And that's why I like the idea of doing Carnage, because the thing is too, like, one of the big mistakes I had with the Raimi Spider-Man films, big bone to pick that I had, one of the mistakes I think Sam Raimi made, let me rephrase that properly.
Okay.
English. Do I even speak it? One of the issues I had is he took three films to ramp up into one of the most iconic villains. And when he did it, he clouded that film with Sandman, and both of them came off as really piss poor. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Venom only showed up for, like, what, 10 minutes at the end? Like,
right.
The actual Venom?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, if you're going to do Venom and you're going to do symbiote storyline, you got to do Carnage. And Carnage, because that's the thing, is Venom is like your in-between, you know what I mean? He's a villain for Spider-Man a lot of times, but he's not 100% a villain all the time. And so, you know, what angle are they going to go at with this? And Carnage is 100% mean, nasty villain. He's going to, you know, and so that's what makes that potential really, really strong, because you can do a knockdown drag 'em out. Like, they can go ham on each other, and you can do that with the CGI, and they can pull a Man of Steel or a BVS. They can tear the city apart. You know what I mean? Because there's nothing getting in the way of that. And I think that's what people want to see out of a Venom flick. And I think that's the direction you should definitely lean. Kind of like what they did with Deadpool, you know? The creative minds behind Deadpool knew what Deadpool fans wanted to see, and they delivered. It was brutal, it was hilarious, it was off the wall and weird, and we got all of that.
Yeah.
And while Punisher does interact with Spider-Man some in the comic universe, this is it's almost Spider-Man's Punisher, where Venom can do some good. I mean, where the Punisher, I would argue, does mostly good, but he does some bad things to get there. Venom can do some good, but he's mostly just animalistic. He's like, I don't care.
He's impulsive.
Impulsive. Yeah.
Yeah.
And as was Eddie Brock, and I love the original history of Eddie Brock, was he was just this over the edge go-getter trying to get ahead, and he screwed up and he lost his job as a reporter, and then he lost his marriage, and then he lost his family, and he was just one bad decision after another. He's rolling downhill, and that's when Venom grabbed a hold of him, when the whole iconic bell ringing, Spider-Man gets rid of him off the suit, and it finds another host, and Eddie Brock has to be going to the church to do a confessional, and I think he's actually suicidal, if I remember correctly, and Venom lands on him, and then so now you have this impulsive symbiote on top of a guy who'd lost everything and was depressed and already an over-aggressive bad decision maker. Mm-hmm. I think if you can play that, putting Carnage in as the bad guy with the freaking serial killer redneck Cletus, come on.
There's a lot of potential there.
Oh, yeah.
There is.
And that's you mentioned Punisher. One of the big issues I think a lot of people had with the Tom Jane Punisher is that it just didn't...
He didn't show his penis?
What? No. you're weird.
Dude, have you not seen Hulk? Because, you know, it was a good show.
Who didn't love you enough?
You, Claude? You!
The issue is that it was tonally off the mark. You know what I mean? Part of it being a PG-13 flick, it wasn't as brutal as it needed to be. And what was fantastic about Daredevil, you know, offering up a real Punisher was absolutely as brutal as we expected. And that's what you have to do with Venom. Venom has to be a savage, brutal fighter. He has to, you know, and then so he needs a villain that can stand with him. you know, that they can trade, you know what I mean, and just go ham on each other. So I really think that's an important thing. If they choose a different kind of antagonist, it's got to be someone who's compelling, man. It's got to be someone that is unbelievable, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we'll see. Maybe they'll do something crazy. I don't know. No, I'm not going to say that because I would be too crazy. It would never happen. But yeah, no, they're... Yeah, so I'm hopeful because the director is a solid director. The main actor is a solid actor who commits. That's a big thing for me, too, is like Topher Grace, he's kind of legendary for being very arrogant. I mean, like, there's stories about the last episode of That 70s Show where he, like, did his final scene and he literally just walked away. Like, while everybody else was posing on stage for, you know, end of shoot cast photos and stuff and, like, kind of interacting and all that stuff, he literally just walked away.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so he's kind of legendary for that. And he strikes me as the kind of guy who probably thought he was, you know, above fully committing to that role because he played it very, you know, lame. Like he didn't, I don't know. He just didn't seem firmly invested to me. And so I don't think we'll have that problem again. I'm hopeful.
I think he leaned into his talents, but it's not American Gothic, American with Lex Luthor in it and Twilight Chick, where he's an undercover or he's a sleeper agent. Lex Luthor, I cannot remember anybody's actor's names. Okay, just roll with me here. So Lex Luthor is a CIA sleeper agent, and he gets woken up by a code phrase. Was it that?
You're talking about Lex Luthor from Smallville?
No. Talking about BVS. BVS Lex.
Oh, okay. Jesse Eisenberg.
It's American something, and people are out there screaming what it is. But it's an interesting film. It's definitely over the top. I enjoyed the crap out of it. But Topher is basically the bad guy in that film. And he does it actually pretty well because the whole character is supposed to be somebody so arrogant, as we all imagine the CIA people are when they're up and coming, that, I mean, he's taken over a position. He's trying to scrub a whole program. And he thinks he knows better than everybody else. And that sticks through. And what you said about what we've heard about his personality, maybe he leaned into his strengths for that. But he was decent in that film.
Mm-hmm.
Carmella, what about you? What do you think about Venom and Tom Hardy?
Well, I love Tom Hardy. I think he's a great actor. He's great in Inception. I'm actually kind of with Klotz. I would like to see Carnage because I think that would be stepping up really big for a first movie. But I think that would be really awesome if they could pull that off. Just because Carnage is such a wild character on his own, and I think he would match up with a Venom really well. So, I'm with Klotz. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah,
it's nice to have some support for once.
like we don't ever support you. All right, that was a statement, not a disagreement. Marvel, so... All right, so we know Disney XD does okay with the Marvel animation. It is definitely teen-oriented, which is fine. But it does some of the Guardian stuff that they've done has been really good. The Rocket and Groot one-offs are actually pretty funny, but definitely kid-oriented. I came across this, and I brought it up for the three of us to say, I don't know. Because there was so much about Secret Wars, and then they tried to do Secret Wars 2. But here's the thing. This falls in our wheelhouse. According to BleedingCool.com, Marvel's Secret Wars cartoon will premiere on June 17th on Disney XD. The animation looks like it's for older kids and young adults, which is something I can get into, definitely. But it says here, first announced last year, San Diego Comic-Con. It's basically the Avengers Season 4, but it's going to be titled Avengers : Secret Wars for the fourth season. But basically, they keep rebranding stuff, right? Marvel does, and relaunching things. And that's what they're doing here. It's the fourth season of the Avengers cartoon. Animated series, I guess, is a better way to put it. They're going to tackle Secret Wars. They're going to be doing a bunch of one-offs that drop in that tell you the background of Black Widow, Hulk, Ant-Man, everybody who's involved. I don't know, man. We keep coming back to this, Klaus. Is there nothing new under the sun? I mean, has Marvel lost all creativity as far as trying new things?
I feel, well, keep in mind that Marvel Comics is different from, you know, whoever's going to make Marvel TV stuff and who's going to make Marvel films. Completely different groups of people that mm-hmm. probably work together to a certain degree, but, you know, it depends on what the goal of the show is. So if the goal of the show is to kind of take that storyline and present it to a younger audience, I kind of get why they're going that direction. It ties into a number of books that, you know, young kids would be able to go out and grab because they'd be, you know, at this point, they'd be very many months past being current, so they could go catch whole storylines or whatever. Because, I mean, ideally, like, if I were the person strategizing the offerings, the content offerings from Marvel properties, I would want stuff that kind of ties back into the core business. You know, so you want a cartoon that feeds back into things that are going on in your comic book, so you have, you know, residual sales from that. You know, the films, obviously, they generate interest in certain books, like Guardians of the Galaxy, what that did for those book lines.
Yes.
You know what I mean? A lot of exposure. Which is great, too, because, like, with Guardians, for example, because the story is so different in the films to the comics, it's exposing a whole new audience to the comic storylines. They're going to lose some people because of that, because they're going to be like, this is nothing like these movies. This is dumb. And they're going to walk away. But a lot of other people are going to be like, oh, hey, you know, if I read the comics, I don't, you know, because I've heard people make the argument, I don't need to read comic books. I just watch the movies and I know what's going on. I'm like, but it's a completely different story. Like, I'm like, every time I'm like,
yeah,
there are whole story arcs that will never make it to film. Or, you know, never be in an animated show or an animated short or individual feature. So, like, if you're a fan of the characters and you want to see real stories, you got to read some of the books once in a while, you know? So hopefully if it's something like that, it'll work out fine. But, yeah, no, they've got a real gap right now in quality content, as we've spoken to at great length on the show recently. I don't want to say that this is just more of that, because I don't think it's fair to criticize the animated side of things replicating what's been done in as comic events. You know what I mean? I think that's kind of its job.
And, well, like, yeah, and if you love the Secret Wars, which I admit I haven't really read, I wanted to read it, I haven't had a chance to read it. I've heard decent things about it. So if you read Secret Wars and now you want to have something to relate to your teens or kids, or maybe you're just a fan of the animation and you want to see it yourself, you may be excited about this. I'm not saying it's a negative thing. I just saw it and went, I guess my first reaction was, I don't know, which leads to hesitancy.
Yeah, because, well, I guess as a fan, you have to look at this. Do you want your animated, you know, offerings for the comic properties that you care about to be replications of, you know, book events, or do you want them to be unique stories unto themselves? Because it works both ways. Like, sometimes seeing, you know, something come off the page and made into a motion picture really works. And then sometimes it's really cool to just see a whole new story. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I'm sure, being that this is it's Disney XD, so this is aimed at younger audiences. You know what I mean?
Just so everybody knows, Disney Channel is like primary school through middle school. Disney Junior is for pre-K and early first grade, kindergarten, those kind of things. And Disney XD is your preteens, 11 through 17 or whatever, typically.
Yeah, it's still going to be relatively light. You know what I mean? Yes. This isn't going to be like the straight-to-video stuff that DC puts out, for example, some of that stuff, or even that Marvel has done a few of. This isn't going to be hardcore. So it's not going to be the full Secret Wars event anyways. You know what I mean?
Right. Now, Carmella, you know, we keep rattling on about this kind of stuff, as we do. Do you have any thoughts on it?
No, I think because Marvel is doing so much right now, and, you know, with the cinematic universe, they prove that, okay, we can do a comedy, because that's Guardians of the Galaxy. But on the TV side of things, you have more, you know, Daredevil and Jessica Jones and Luke Cage. And that's not really aimed towards kids, or people who, like, there are sometimes I'll watch Daredevil and I have to, like, look away from the screen for a couple minutes because of what's going on. But I think an animated series, for people who are not necessarily into the real visceral stuff that they do, I think this is a great outlet to, if you are interested in the Avengers and you want to see more of that, I think this is a great way to go about it. So I'm interested in it. I will at least give it a shot like I normally do. And we'll see how it goes. But I think it's a good idea. I think it expands into people who may not always have something to go and watch because they can't watch Daredevil or Jessica Jones.
And I will say, the stuff I've watched on Disney XD with my kids, if you're looking, as a parent, if you're looking to sit down and connect with your kids, your teenagers, whatever, I have sat down and watched, I think there's Team Hulk Smash or Hulk Smash, something like that. There's definitely an Avengers or this Avengers series. There's Guardians of the Galaxy. I've enjoyed them. While there are definitely some lighter moments and some, that was a little too kiddie. I think they could have stuck with the heavier tone and still been okay. It's definitely enjoyable. It's definitely quality. And I'd be interested in somebody who loves Secret Wars, the comic series, and then also who maybe watches this as it comes out and says, you know, gives the comparison. That'd be fun.
Now, if they're doing it for a quick
time, that's,
and they're not putting a whole lot of effort into it, then that's lame. But it sounds like, based on what you've seen and what they've got in here with the animation style, it looks like it actually might be pretty decent. So,
yeah, I mean, it could be. So we definitely have time for one last thing. I tagged at the very end. I started talking about this with Carmela and Paul beforehand, and we weren't sure we were going to get to it. But my friend Hugh of the Roadshow is what he does. I've known him forever, and he's always finding things to entertain himself online. He never fails to come. He comes twice a year to my house and hangs out. He'll be at Dragon Con. Actually, Paul, you'll get to meet him at Dragon Con. So he comes for this weekend, Memorial Day weekend. He comes for Labor Day weekend. And this time he says, yeah, you know, all these old 8-bit games and this and that. He's prattling on. I'm like, He's like, go check out old-games.com. Old-games, because you could download any of it for free, and it's super slow. But if you pay just $8 for the month, you'll get 30 days. You can download as much as you want. It's super fast. And I was like, all right, whatever. Finally, last night, he taught me into looking it up and downloading some stuff. So I got to looking on there. And the first thing I looked at, he loves the old Leisure Suit Larry games. I'm like, all right, you know, tell me which one. I'll try one of these. Fine. I haven't played it in forever. Right. I hear Carmela laughing.
I've played the Leisure Suit Larry games.
Yeah. And his style is very adventure. He's very adventure oriented. He loves the point and click games and finding the puzzles and solving the mysteries. And that's his style, which is not really my style, but that's fine. So I was like, I'd just been talking to my friend Brad Willis about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and how we'd grown up with the arcade game on the Super NES and the Nintendo and this and that, and playing it and just fond memories. So I looked it up. And sure enough, they have two or three of the Turtle games on there. So I decided to try them out. They had Double Dragon, but it's the arcade version, so it's not the one I liked from Nintendo.
Right.
But they have Double Dragon on there. And sure enough, all of these games are... I'm not sure what you have to do coding-wise, but basically they've been made to where they'll run on all modern machines. So Windows 7, Windows 10, it'll list out basically every Windows that's been released. It says it works on all of these. And I have a Windows 10 PC that I don't do much with, so I decided to try it out. And while there's no instructions, you have to figure out what the buttons do, and it helps if you have a controller connected to it. Some games are bigger than others, and you have to do a virtual DVD-ROM, basically, to run it. It will run on your computer. And I was telling Carmela, I found, like, Neverwinter Nights and Icewind Dale. And I'm trying to think what would – I think Warhammer 40K, Klotz, does that get your interest there?
I mean, sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I think Warhammer, one of the Warhammers, was on there. If you like older games, now Carmela, I want you to share the story you shared beforehand about what you remember about these games when you were growing up.
So, like, I would play them, and you know, you'd have to go to school, and this is before save cards, memory cards. So you would pause it, and then you'd have to go to school, and it'd be on. Your Nintendo would be on all day. And then I'd come home and I'd pause it and just finish playing.
Just finish playing. Now, you're not going to find your super, not yet. They're adding stuff every day. I don't know about licensing, but this is, I'm talking about, this is stuff that's, the licenses, I believe, have pretty much been lapsed, and they're not charging for the games. These are basically emulators or ROMs, as you would imagine. And you're not going to find your original Mario Kart or anything like that. But I absolutely grabbed Neverwinter Nights. I remember playing the crap out of that game in the 90s. Klotz, you have any older games? I mean, I know you own like a bajillion games on Steam, but do you have any fond memories of older games that you enjoy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been gaming my entire life, so there's lots of classic games that I'll play from time to time. Oh, man, when Skyrim was first coming out, Bethesda gave away Daggerfall, the second Elder Scrolls game, through, I think it was through GOG at the time. And that was really cool. They just gave it away for free. And that was really fun to go back, because that was like, that was a game that I cut my teeth on growing up. It was one of the first like really crazy PC RPGs that I ever played, and like a huge world, like way bigger world than any of the modern games. Because I mean, modern games are fully rendered and everything. You know what I mean? Like there's every blade of grass and everything is placed and all that kind. You know what I mean? Like, but back then it was like, it was this just massive experience, you know what I mean? It was repetitive in hindsight, but it was like, it was huge. But yeah, no, there's a lot of great games from the 90s, late 90s in particular, mid to late 90s, some early 2000s stuff that is, it won't look amazing, you know, by modern standards, but there's some great gameplay principles there. Like, there's some really, and the really cool part about a lot of the early games is, of the, what I would call the modern age of gaming, because obviously there's been games like computer games and console games and even, you know, cabinet games for decades upon decades. But like, it was the 90s when game systems started getting in everybody's home, computers started getting in everybody's home, you know, all that kind of stuff. But what we're kind of at nowadays is we're in this weird place where a lot of games are becoming kind of homogenous because we know what works now. You know what I mean?
Yes.
We know what audiences respond to. We know what people expect out of an experience. That's what makes going back so fun. Like, what makes so makes it really exceptional sometimes is going back and seeing, like, man, some of these games have some clunky mechanics, but I'll be damned if that's not half of the appeal sometimes. You know what I mean? Like, just to go see, like, before things were so, you know, well-sculpted, I guess, is the way I would put it. You know what I mean? So... yeah, classic games are great.
So cool. We lost the connection there. But yeah, as he's talking about, Elder Scrolls is all there. Elder Scrolls Arena, 1994. Elder Scrolls of Daggerfall. Daggerfall, 1996. Elder Scrolls Redguard. Morrowind, 2002. Oblivion, 2006. They're all here, so you can check those out. I want to talk about some of my favorite things that are going on right now before I get off here. Again, I was on Trivial Warfare. That's trivialwarfare.com. Trivial, like trivia with an L, trivialwarfare.com. That's where Carmella Smith is every week. She does an amazing job there, so check her out there. Check out the Trivial Warfare Army on Facebook. I was glad to be a host this past weekend, and that will air in a couple of weeks, and we'll tell you again about that. And check out Giant Size Team Up Network, the Travis Jones, a Blazing Defender Report. We keep referencing him, and we love him so much. So check out Travis Jones and the Blazing Defender Report over at GiantSizeTeamUp.com. You can do that and email us. Email us at btp@giantsizeteamup.com. Go to giantsizeteamup.com/breakingthepanel, and you can leave your SpeakPipe voicemail there. And, of course, we're on Facebook as Breaking the Panel. Twitter's Panel Breakers. Patreon is Breaking the Panel. All that jazz. And definitely make plans for Dragon Con, because it's going to be awesome. So tune in next week to hear Chris say nothing, because he's still going to be gone. Thanks for tuning in. Check out Giant Size Team Up Network. We love you all.
Breaking the Panel is the flagship podcast on the Giant Size Team Up Network. You can support the show at patreon.com/breakingthepanel, and you'll find more of our amazing podcasts at giantsizeteamup.com.